I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. At Lighthouse, we're celebrating 23 years in business and just entering our 11th year of doing open line. We have a few new exciting changes. First, we have our new open line format that comes with the launching of our new website. You can also find an archive of past topics on the publication event tab. And any topic you can pretty much think of in your business, we have it on there. And if you don't see it, let us know. We'll make that one of our publication topics for 2018-2019. Our second book, Cracking the Business Code, is available on Amazon, or you can click on the book icon on our homepage. Plus, in 2018, we'll have our third book out. Yes, we are crazy enough to do a third book, Cracking the Team Building Code, available then. And we also now offer skills testing, which has become very, very popular, and that was created at the request of our clients. Those that work with Lighthouse might have met Glenn Croy, who is a new senior consultant and COO for Lighthouse. He started earlier this year. Glenn has been our CEO of companies with between 60 to 600 employees with a strong OD background. We're so glad to have Glenn as part of our team, and I'm sure many of you that are clients will get to meet him over time. Our topic today is staying out of the quicksand when it comes to employment law issues. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services, and we'll be hosting our program today. We have just a few housekeeping items, and we're going to jump right into this amazing topic. For those of you joining us for the very first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement, bringing effective insight to your organization. We do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments to raise the hiring bar and assist companies with a variety of services, including interpersonal coaching, team building, stress management workshops, and much, much more. We have an office in Taiwan, so if you have an operation in Asia and would like to get leadership coaching for them or providing ideas on how to best interact with a U.S.-based company, please let us know. We also now have an affiliate office in Europe, so we truly are a global organization. We made it. Our Keeping on Track open line series is in response to the calls that we get from many of our clients, both domestically and globally, to address the various business issues that organizations are facing today. And that's how this topic came about. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen, you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas during our discussion. We'll attempt to respond as many as possible. So please join us with your thoughts and insights along the way. And at the conclusion of our program, we're going to open up our line so you can talk directly with our guest, Lorraine. And if you want to wait till the end, just write down two or three questions, and we'll be more than happy to get to you if we can. We have a large audience today. It's a very hot topic. I want to introduce our special guest today, who is a personal friend, business colleague, client, and known around the United States for the expert work that Vantaggio does. Lorraine is the president of Vantaggio HR. Two themes are woven throughout Lorraine's diverse career: a passion for a job well done and a zest for continually learning and improving. Lorraine infuses Vantaggio HR with these qualities every day. And I can tell you from our clients that work with Vantaggio, that's absolutely the truth. When she founded the firm back in 1994, Lorraine combined her rare talent in understanding what a client needs and her gift for business foresight to create a company that can service the HR and management consulting needs of small and large companies equally well. Today, Vantaggio serves clients across the country from their offices in California, Hawaii, and New York. Her career experience helps employers realize their HR goals and attempt to shifting HR landscape. Lorraine is a veteran HR executive and entrepreneur with 25 years of international, corporate, and consulting experience. Her bold career has taken her to employment and business opportunities in Europe and multiple U.S. cities. Lorraine's perspective on the impact culture has is on a business that makes her sought after within the industry and for associations to give talks on many of the topics we're going to cover today. She conducts frequent seminars on HR topics with an emphasis on employment law compliance and is frequently asked to co-speak with employment law attorneys. Publications around the country rely on Lorraine as a recognized HR expert. The California Small Business Association has appointed her several years running as chair of the Labor Issues Legislative Advisory Committee and has served several terms on the board of directors. Lorraine was nominated by Ernst & Young's Entrepreneur of the Year Award. Wow, I didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
Thank you.
And her company was honored by being named the Small Business of the Year in California Senate Minority Leader, Senator Dick Ackerman. Wow, another biggie. Vantaggio has also received the prestigious award of being named one of the top 25 women-owned businesses in the United States by Working Mother magazine. In addition, Lorraine is a member and frequent lecturer for PIRA, for SHRM, and sits on the boards of directors for several business organizations and private firms. She is also a founding member of one of the Orange County chapters of YPO. Lorraine was featured in Orange County's Metro's Top 20 Women to Watch edition and was recently nominated for the Orange County Business Journal's Women in Business Award. Lorraine received a bachelor's degree from Wellesley College and conducted graduate-level studies in linguistics at the Sorbonne in Paris. She resides in San Juan Capistrano. You have a great restaurant down there for pasta. where she balances the vigorous demands of growing Vantaggio HR with the art of managing a successful marriage and raising two children. All of this at the same time. In her spare time, Lorraine pursues two other longtime passions, gourmet cooking and traveling. How do you do this?
I don't know. I don't sleep very much, but
yeah. I feel privileged to have Lorraine with us today and to share ideas that will help each of us in preparing for the future and for dealing with today's business issues. Also, registration for our next program will begin at the end of today's program. The topic will be, it's always time to raise the hiring bar. Lorraine, I want to welcome you to Open Line.
Thank you, Dana. Oh, my goodness. And thank you for that mouthful of an introduction that I better have some really smart and wonderful information for people today after all those accolades that you gave. So looking forward to it. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So if anyone out there wanted to just quickly send a chat through, I just want to make sure that I can see it on my screen. And as Dana mentioned, as we're moving along through these different areas of employment law quicksand, if you have comments or questions, you don't need to hold them to the end. To the extent possible and as time permitting, we'll try to address them as they come up. If I happen, Dana, not to be able to see them for whatever reason, I'm sure you'll ping me and let me know that we've got a question.
Just focus on the program and I'll take care of the fielding.
Awesome. Thank you. All right. Well, first thing I want to say is that one of the things I have to constantly remind my friends, colleagues, clients is that these seemingly small mistakes that you could make as an employer sometimes can lead to an incredible amount of liability. And the problem is that some of the laws and many of the laws that we end up dealing with don't make intuitive business sense. A quick anecdote, a company that we started doing some work for within the last year, a very large organization in California, got dinged with a lawsuit over seemingly minutia, but it dealt with information that you're supposed to put on somebody's pay stub. So, you know, as employers and we process payroll, we're used to that. We know there's a whole bunch of information that has to go on a pay stub, one of which is the period that the person's being paid for and the pay date. Well, this company had been, since the dawn of time, paying its employees weekly, and the pay stub read period ending with the Friday that the period ended and then the pay date. And they actually ended up in a class action lawsuit that resulted in almost $8 million of fines because the pay stubs did not say the first day in the work week and the last day in the work week.
Oh, my goodness.
that to me is obscene. But as employers, this is the context of the world that we live in today, where silly little mistakes and the non-silly mistakes can really cost us very, very dearly. So it's becoming more and more challenging to keep on top of all of this, and the onus really is shifting to business managers and HR managers to almost be mini employment law experts. Come on. And one of the things that I want to mention today, if anyone wants to chat through and just tell me what state you're in, it would be kind of just interesting to see that. But I want to make clear that today our focus is going to be on federal law. There are many, many areas where state law is going to either overlap or intersect or usurp federal law. I will try to the extent possible to give a few examples where I really think on this specific issue you need to go back and check what state law is on the area, in that area. And I'm also just going to suggest that if you have questions about how the law is different in the state that you're in on any of these subjects, please reach out to me. We won't be able to go over every state questions on today's conversation, but it's an important point. And if any of you were tuned in prior to our official start, I had mentioned to Dana that we are now seeing a trend across the country that cities are starting to pass their own employment laws with regards to things like minimum wage and paid sick days. So we've now got a third jurisdiction that's impacting how we treat our employees that we have to pay attention to. We're going to go over some of the top mistakes that in my career I have and I continue to see companies make that get them into trouble with employment law. And when I say getting into trouble with employment law, it sometimes means a lawsuit. It sometimes means just unhappy employees, which is never good for business. It sometimes translates into an audit with one of the state or federal agencies. It can have a lot of different ramifications. It could mean a call and an investigation by the local labor commissioner. All of these things can cost money and time to organizations. So one of the biggest mistakes that I constantly see is, I'm going to call it FLSA misclassification. This is somebody exempt or non-exempt? And just quick reminder that if you're an exempt employee, it means we do not have to pay you overtime. You are exempt from the minimum wage and overtime rules. And if you are a non-exempt person, we have a lot of requirements about how we need to treat you as an employee, primarily this concept of needing to be able to pay overtime appropriately. So we see companies too often relying just on somebody's salary. Oh, I've called that person manager of XYZ or director of ABC, and thinking that that rises the bar high enough to be able to consider the person exempt, which is not the case. We see people being not careful about using the retail sales and outside sales exemption rules. Lots of companies that pay people commission only and get in trouble on overtime and minimum wage. We see problems with the computer exemption, docking policies, and making inappropriate deductions. We could probably spend all of the rest of our time today going into details on all of these. I'm going to really breeze through quickly on these key areas where people get in trouble. Another thing I just wanted to mention before we move forward is that we have a lot of slides today that go into a level of detail that we don't have the time to go over. And that was not a mistake. It was intentional, because we want you to be able to download these slides afterward and have them as a resource. So again, questions on things that we're going to go over quickly today, please feel free to reach out to us later. So the retail sales exemption, oops, I'm making sure I went ahead. Not too many slides. No, that's correct. The retail sales exemption is only permitted in an organization that truly is a retail sales service establishment. And the rule there on the federal level is that it means 75% of the company's annual dollar volume needs to be actually in the sale of goods and services. For a person to be able to be considered an exempt employee who is engaged in retail sales, they have to earn at least 1.5 times federal minimum wage, and they have to have more than 50% of their compensation during what they would consider a representative period come from the form of commission. So without going into terrible amount of detail on this, I think you could all see that if you hire someone, you stick them in a retail sales facility, you pay them simply commission only. If they're in an intro period where they're not ramped up yet, or they're in a period where there's a lull in sales, it would be very, very easy to run afoul of this rule and end up inappropriately not paying the person overtime. In fact, it's quite common in retail sales establishments to put people on commission only, and I personally know of many, many class action lawsuits where the employees come back and say, I was paid commission only and never got my due overtime. So it's something to really pay attention to. The plaintiff's attorneys love that. So that's for folks that work within the confines of your organization in sales. Outside sales is actually a different set of rules. So when we say outside sales, it's the person that goes outside of your place of business and is, you know, the old model of knocking on doors trying to procure business. But to be exempt from overtime requirements, if you are in an outside sales capacity, you have to have your primary duty actually going out and procuring business outside of the employer's place of business. I have clients that try to get clever about this and say, oh, well, I have Jane and Fred working from, they work from a home office, therefore they're outside of our company and I pay them commission only and they don't get minimum wage and they don't get overtime. That doesn't work. The government considers that they really have to be engaged in sales calls going to see your clients. And they're very picky about how much you can do via phone, web, any kind of social media. They really want the person out and about meeting with people. So again, an exemption very frequently utilized incorrectly where we have a salesperson, we pay them commission, and we just consider them exempt. So it's something to be careful about. The computer exemption, computer professionals can be considered exempt. I'm not going to go through all of these tests. You guys have the slides. You can read them. Just know that your normal IT person, your IT help desk, your person that comes and installs programs on your computer, it does not rise to the level of what the federal and most state governments consider to be senior enough computer work to be considered an exempt employee. It is very, very high-level analytical design analysis creation type of work that an employee would need to be doing and would need to be paid at a sufficient level, and you can see those amounts there on the screen, in order to be considered an exempt computer professional. Your normal IT person in an organization is someone that you are almost certainly have to be keeping track of their hours and paying overtime to. The other place where we mentioned earlier companies get in trouble is when they have someone who is truly classified as an exempt employee, but then they accidentally make deductions out of that employee's paycheck that would disqualify them from being exempt. And I'm going to, before getting into the details, explain the concept. So to be an exempt employee, not only do you have to have certain duties, as we've been mentioning, to meet different types of the exemptions, but there's also a requirement for most of the exemptions for the person to be paid on a salaried basis. So the government looks at it this way. If you are truly an exempt employee, I pay you a salary to get the job done. I'm not paying you by hour. I'm not paying you by widget. And the minute I decide that I'm going to pay you a salary and I start docking money out of your paycheck, I've sort of defeated my argument that you are a senior enough level person that you're getting paid on this salaried basis. So when you start doing things like taking money out of somebody's check for some of the examples on the screen, arriving late, leaving early, if they're absent for jury duty, military leave, those types of things would potentially cause you to lose the exemption, not only for that individual, but that entire classification of employees. Okay. There are a few places when it is okay when somebody is an exempt employee to still take some deductions out of their salary. You can prorate the initial and final week of work. You can take full days out of their paycheck if they've missed time for personal reasons or sickness or accident, if you have a bona fide sick pay plan in place. to offset some fees for good faith penalties for major safety infractions. Note, this is one of the areas where state law can be tremendously different. So if you are in a state where you're a little bit unsure about when you can or can't take money out of a salaried exempt person's paycheck, please reach out to me and I'll give you specifics on that. There are some states, California is notorious for it, where they actually are completely disagree with the federal rules on these. For example, California, for those of you that happen to be in California who are on the call, does not allow you to take good faith penalties for safety infractions out of somebody's paycheck. It's one of the examples.
Wow.
Yeah. There is a safe harbor for this. As long as you have a clearly communicated policy and you reimburse people if you've made an improper deduction and you have a good faith commitment to comply in the future, so you know that you can be considered not subject to the exemption being disqualified. So it's good to put a policy in your handbook. It's good to pay attention. If you realize you've done any of these wrong, you correct them. You correct them quickly. This will not prevent you from being in trouble if you repeatedly, you can't use this every time. But what this goes to is the infrequent or the unintentional mistake that then gets corrected. You won't lose the exemption. But again, be careful. Don't try to overutilize the safe harbor. Okay, so that's what exempt, non-exempt employees and overtime is a big area of problems that we see. The next one, and I would love to hear from any of you, if any of you out there pay your employees piece rate, this is an area where it's also kind of very hip for plaintiffs' attorneys to go after companies on class action lawsuits. Piece rate is when I comment in the automotive and the manufacturing world, I pay you X number of dollars for every widget you manufacture, I pay you Y number of dollars for every transmission you change, and you don't have an hourly rate of pay. Companies get in trouble with this because piece rate employees are considered non-exempt employees. So even though we're paying them for the job that they perform or the widget that they manufacture, we still should be maintaining timesheets. And if that person works over 40 hours in a week based on federal law, or if you happen to be in one of the few states that has laws regarding overtime being due on a daily basis, you still have to do the math and back into what that person's hourly rate of pay would be and calculate if you owe them overtime. You also need to ensure that for all of the hours worked, they're getting paid minimum wage. So this is a way of paying employees that I find sometimes say, well, the whole reason we're doing it that way is because we don't want to bother having to, you know, have timesheets and calculating overtime. Well, the government doesn't see it that way. They allow you to pay a piece rate, but they still want to ensure people are being protected with regards to minimum wage and overtime. Certain states, again, California being one of them, that make paying overtime extraordinarily difficult because on top of these issues of having to maintain timesheets and calculate overtime correctly, California imposes some very significant additional restrictions that if anybody wants more information about that, please reach out to me. Mistake number three, and this is a biggie, when I lecture on this one, people say to me, oh my goodness, when did that become the law? And I tell them that it goes back to the Fair Labor Standards Act back in 1941, 1947. Somebody could look that up for us and post it online. I'm drawing a blank, but it's been very, very long time that we've had this regulation on the state level. When you have a non-exempt employee and they are paid multiple rates of pay, that could either be I pay you when you're working on client A $12 an hour, and when you're working on client B, you get paid $14 an hour. It could be that they have they earn commission on top of an hourly rate of pay. People, when they are paid with this in this blended capacity, when we go to pay them things like overtime and a few other things, we're supposed to be looking at total pay that we pay them, dividing by the number of hours worked, and coming up with what's called a blended rate of pay. I call it the blended rate of pay. The government refers to it as the regular rate of pay, which I find extraordinarily confusing. I think of regular rate of pay as being that base hourly rate, but that's their terminology and we're stuck with it. So the things that you do not have to include in this calculation of what is the person's quote-unquote regular rate of pay are discretionary bonuses, which means, hey, Dana, you did a great job this year. I'm writing you a check for $500. We get to ignore that in this calculation. We ignore the premium pay that we pay people for overtime, vacation, holiday, sick time pay, expenses, or benefits. And I'm going to give you guys an example here. Oh, perfect. It comes up right here. If I do pay you a bonus that is a non-discretionary bonus, so Dana, if you successfully complete your projects all by Friday, you get an extra $150 this week. That is a non-discretionary bonus. We've kind of spelled out the rules. You can expect it. You can calculate it. We get to the end of this work week, and I, as the employer, when I'm running payroll, I have to factor that extra bonus that I paid the person in when I calculate overtime. So this walks you through, this little spreadsheet here walks you through an example of how we would need to do this math. So if we were paying a person $14 an hour and they worked a 40-hour work week, they'd make $560. Let's say they worked 3 hours of overtime, and overtime gets paid at 1.5 times the regular rate of pay, right? So we have $3 of overtime, or 3 hours of overtime, I'm sorry, not $3. And then that 50% premium that we pay them, the 1.5, remember on the previous slide I said we can ignore that. That doesn't need to get factored into the equation. But we would look at their straight time rate of pay of $14 an hour for the 43 hours that they worked. We would have to add in that bonus. That gives us the total of what the person earned in the week for this purpose, and then we divide by the person having worked 43 hours a week in this week. So you can see that this math plays out to being that this blended or regular rate of pay is actually $17.49, not $14. So when this employee of mine worked overtime that week, I'm not supposed to have been counting their overtime at $14 an hour. I'm supposed to be counting and calculating the overtime based on that $17.49 number. This is something that many companies are not aware of. It's something that many companies are not doing correctly. And I personally have two clients in class action lawsuits right now because of this very issue. It's a hot topic with plaintiff's attorneys. They've seen this as a place to go and find lots and lots and lots of money for their clients and for themselves. And I think it's an area that we all as employers have to really be intentional about getting better at doing.
Lorraine, and also I want to let everybody know, we're going to be sending out these slides in audio in a couple of days, so you'll have that format. A question came in that, let me paraphrase this, that some companies, if there's a lawsuit, some organizations just pay the $35,000 or whatever it is and get it off. Or is it better to pay it off or is it better to fight? Because there's going to be money out either way.
It's such a good question, and it's hard to answer because these things are so case-specific. I am finding that there is a pattern where employees sue or they go get an attorney to write a letter, and companies don't want to go to the expense of the cost of fighting it, so they settle. A lot of times, settling and paying out the $35,000 or whatever number you guys suggested will be less money than what it would cost you to fight it and even prevail in court. And at the very end of our presentation, I have a slide with some statistics about what these types of lawsuits are trending and costing companies.
Okay.
I worry about it being trend-setting. I worry about the message that it sends to the people that may not be very honest out there. All you need to do is make a complaint, and we're going to settle and pay you some money. But if you wanted to tackle every one of these on a matter of principle, it could get extremely expensive for companies. So it's hard to give you a right and wrong answer.
Yeah, it was interesting because a client of ours, they over this how to calculate, they didn't. Like you mentioned, most companies aren't aware of it. Employee got an attorney to write the letter, wanted $250,000.
Ouch.
And then the company got an attorney, and they went back and forth, didn't spend a lot of time on it, and they ended up just paying a check for $42,000 and go away and put a lot of can't come close to the company and all these restrictions on it.
It gets me frustrated, to tell you the truth. It really does. So, and in addition to needing to do that special math for the blended rate of pay when you're calculating overtime, there are some state laws that require you to use that special 1749 number instead of the $14 number when, for example, you're paying people out for their paid sick days. Oregon requires this. I don't know why that says SCA. That's supposed to be California, and I'm sorry, we'll correct that slide. California does require you look at a certain 90-day look-back period. Some states actually require that you use that blended rate of pay, too, when you're paying penalties to employees for missed rest breaks and meal periods. So there's a lot of opportunity, if you're not doing that calculation correctly, to be tripped up, and you end up paying the employee too little money. So this is mistake number four is really sort of a continuation of mistake number three. We're not using that correct blended rate of pay when we're calculating overtime. And this really, as I was mentioning, is the place where it's class action lawsuit material. I don't want to spend the time, because we don't have it, to actually walk through this calculation very carefully with you. But this is an example based on that previous slide that I gave you, where we said somebody who were paying $14 an hour and we gave that $150 bonus to, if we had paid them their overtime for those 3 hours at the $14 an hour, and it compares to what we should have paid them using the correct calculation, okay, you can see that in this situation it comes to, you know, a not a whopping $5.24 that we owed the person in additional overtime. The challenge is that these numbers can be much bigger, and the challenge is that this can go across the board to all of your organization, and depending upon state law, the statute of limitations could be 3-4 years, if not more. And so companies end up in class action lawsuits that are in the millions of dollars. A client of mine that operates some training facilities was paying their employees who were trainers minimum wage, but these people were subject to pretty significant commissions when they taught certain classes or sold memberships to the training facilities. Some of these people, despite the fact that they were minimum wage employees, really were taking in some very serious amount of money at the end of the day if they were successful. And this company is right now in the process of dealing with this class action lawsuit for a small group of their employees, but it's close to $1 million that they may owe if they aren't able to settle this out. So the implications, don't let the $5.24 example on this slide make you believe that this isn't a significant and could be a very costly issue. It really can be. So when you do have commissions and bonuses, you do have to factor those in as well. So you would have to take a look at, if you are paying somebody a commission and bonus, over what period did that commission and bonus reward the person? And this example is that if I paid somebody a $500 commission in March for the work that the person did in February, I would have to go back to February. And if we had 5 weeks in February, I would prorate that commission over each one of the weeks. And I'd have to go back and look at all those individual weeks back in February to see how many hours that person worked, and do that funky math that I just showed you, figuring out where we might owe people that incremental additional overtime.
Question came in. How do you do the calculations? Can the payroll or timekeeping system be programmed to do the math?
I have yet to see a payroll or timekeeping system that does this well. There are third-party bridge software that can be developed and put in place that is very costly. Unfortunately, this kind of pushes us back to having to do this math via Excel spreadsheet. If you are going to go to the trouble of getting your payroll or timekeeping system and try to put some kind of mechanism in to have them have it do these calculations, it's very, very important that you have somebody very knowledgeable about how the math has to work. Check to make sure that things are programmed correctly. The client that I just told you about with the training folks, they thought that their payroll system was calculating this correctly. And when we dug in and started auditing ourselves in preparation for the lawsuit, we found out that the system was grossly deficient in getting the right numbers. So be cautious about it.
Oh, my goodness.
Mistake number five. This is one of my favorite, least favorite ones because it's so incredibly prevalent that employers classify workers as independent contractors that really should be employees. This is a pet peeve of our government, both on the federal and state level. One would hope that the employer and the worker could come to an agreement about how, what kind of relationship they're going to enter into, but they don't leave it up to us. There are many, many factors that are looked at. This is an area as well that is pretty seriously dependent upon state law. I'm going to talk to you about how the Federal Department of Labor and the IRS looks at this. But again, make sure you know what the rules are in your state of operations. The biggest concept here is one of control. So if you as the employer control the work that worker is doing too much, that person really needs to be treated as an employee. The concept of independent contractor, the worker really does to meet need to be quite independent in order for you to legally treat them as a true independent contractor. The liability and the penalties for this is a big one. We've done some calculations that indicate getting this wrong, because the statute of limitations, again, can be multiple years, you could end up paying in penalties and interest and back taxes close to 70% of what you paid the person initially if you get this wrong and you treat them as an independent contractor. This, I'm not going to read all the things on the slide. You guys can see it, but the Federal Department of Labor, these are the factors that the Federal Department of Labor, DOL, looks at in determining whether the person is truly an independent contractor or not. Okay. They really want to see someone that's in business for themselves, that has the opportunity to make money or lose money, and that is providing a service to your company that is not an integral part of your business. I'm an HR consulting firm. If I hire someone to develop a new website for me, that's a job they come in to do. They're an expert. It's their business. They do this for other companies. I'm answering questions. I'm telling them what I want them to do for me, but I'm not really directing their work. That's not my area of expertise. I'm going to probably be able to hire that person as an independent contractor. If I bring on board somebody to be an HR consultant, like my employees who are HR consultants that I send out to our clients and provide HR services, that's what I do for a living. That is what my company sells. My ability in the eyes of the law to treat that person as an independent contractor are very slim. So that's the DOL's test. The IRS, many of you probably remember the IRS 20-factor test. It's a big, long, 20 questions, and you had to answer them all, and the IRS wouldn't tell you whether there was a pass-fail. It was a case-by-case basis. They had this 20-factor test in place for a very, very long time, and a while back now they replaced it with their new 11-factor test. Again, I'm not going to read through every one of these for sake of time, but they look at the same kinds of things that I just explained that the federal DOL looks at. They want to look at the type of the relationship, how much training and instructions are you giving the person. Is the person really in business for themselves? Do they have their own company where they're really providing the service to other third parties? They want to look at the type of relationship. Oops, excuse me. I went too fast there.
Well, Lorraine, actually, we have three questions that came in.
Sure.
The first question, do you have any information on statutory employees? And then the second question, I want to answer that one, then we'll go to the next one.
Yeah, statutory employees is a narrow carve-out that's under federal law about how you sometimes can have somebody be sort of in, I'm kind of call it sort of a midstream in between being an independent contractor and an employee. There's some very specific requirements around that. Whoever asked that question, if you want to reach out to me afterwards, for the sake of time, and it might not apply to everybody, I'd be happy to follow up and get you a lot more information on that.
Okay, great. And you'll see Lorraine's contact information on the screen, of the phone number and email. Second question is, what are the penalties for misclassifying someone as a statutory employee?
Significant. So there are, and this depends, again, on the location that you're in, but you could be held responsible as the employer for back payroll taxes, fines and penalties on top of them. You could actually be held responsible, and people really like want to throw rotten tomatoes at me when I tell them this. If that worker, you misclassify the person as an independent contractor, and that person didn't appropriately pay their own payroll taxes, you as the employer who misclassified them can actually be held liable for those personal taxes that the person should have paid. There are jurisdictions additionally where there are civil penalties. California, a couple of years ago, passed a law that imposes fines of between $5,000 and $25,000 for the intentional misclassification of employee as an independent contractor. It's something not to mess with. This is one that if you get it wrong, it costs way too much money.
And last question before we move on. This individual says, we have people working for us that insist they want to be 1099-D and not a W-2 employee. The person has their own corporation. Aren't we okay then?
Not necessarily. Remember I said earlier that it's not up to the worker and the company. You have those rules that the government looks at, and if the relationship doesn't meet those criteria, the government is going to consider that that person really should have been an employee, even if the person prefers. And a lot of times workers want to be 1099 because they want to be an independent contractor because maybe they're writing off their car and they're writing off a home office and they're maybe flying a little bit footloose and fancy free with their taxes. Just because they want to doesn't really matter. Additionally, if they do have their own corporation, let's go back to my example of if I hire someone to put in a website for me and that person has their own company that provides website creation services to the public and has other clients besides me, then we're probably in okay territory. But I've had a situation, I'll give you an example because it maybe makes it easier to understand. A client of mine hired this lady who worked for them for many, many years. They were a medical practice, and she was basically the office administrator for the medical practice. She had a corporation, she had an S corporation, where she did graphic design services. She did it at another time in her life. She freelanced a little bit outside of her regular job hours doing graphic design. She wasn't doing graphic design for them. She was working as their office administrator. So the fact that she had a business and had a corporation, really, if this company had ever gotten audited on this, would not have flown. It's just the fact that the person has their own company isn't a free get-out-of-jail card.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. I had an attorney buddy of mine many years ago call me up with a client of his and said, hey, my client is really, really tired of paying workers' comp and all these payroll taxes and everything, and we've got this great idea we wanted to run by you. My client's going to give $1,000 to every one of his employees so that they can go set up their own corporation, and then he's going to fire them all as employees and make them independent contractors. And I got a good chuckle, and I told them I gave them A for effort, but they were both going to go to jail if they did that.
we're going to take one more question, and then we're going to hold everything till the end. What are the requirements of a company to reimburse outside sales reps for business expenses? That's part A, phone mileage and travel expenses. And what can the sales rep write off on their own tax returns?
Okay, this depends on whether the sales rep is an employee or an independent contractor. If the this is going to become, to really truly answer the question, would be very case specific. Let me just say generically that if the person is truly an employee, so they are a sales rep working just for your company, not providing the service to other organizations, you have a responsibility to make them whole for all of their expenses that they incur in performing their job. If the person truly is an independent contractor, let's say they make their living sales repping for lots of different companies, they truly are an independent contractor, all you are responsible for paying that person is whatever you guys agreed to as a commission or a rate or fee. And as they are their own independently operated business, their expenses are their responsibility. As far as what they can write off, I'm not going to touch that one if you don't mind, because that really, I could share a little bit of thoughts with you, but because that really is tax advice, it wouldn't be terribly appropriate for me to opine on that.
Okay.
So,
thank you very much. We're going to hold their questions so we open the line up so Lorraine can get through.
Yeah, I'm going to got many more slides to go through. Another big mistake companies make is with bad workers' comp practices. If I had a nickel for every time a client called me and said, well, this person just told us that they have a work-related industry, but she was a crummy employee anyway, and she had really bad absenteeism, and we were getting ready to fire anyway. What can we do now? And I tell them, so sorry, you're out of luck. It's illegal on the federal basis, and there's very specific state laws around this as well, that once the person has either suffered a work comp-related injury or claims that they're going to file a work comp claim, they are in a very protected category where it would be very damaging for your company to try and take adverse action against them. I'm not saying you never can, but it's really dangerous. Companies make the mistake of wanting to try and decide for themselves, well, I don't think that's a true work comp injury. I think that guy got hurt when he was playing softball with his kids on the weekend. I don't want to report it to my work comp carrier. That's a surefire way to get in trouble. You let the doctors make this decision. You file the claim with, you tell your carrier, if you think that this isn't a legitimate claim, you share that with your claims adjuster, but you let the doctor examine the person and make a determination as to whether it's a bona fide work-related injury or not. You have to report these claims, and I know people are so afraid of their work comp rates going up that there's a tendency to not want to report claims, but it will cost you so much more in the long run to not report claims than to report them appropriately and work to fight the ones that you don't think are legitimate. Once somebody gets into the work comp system, there's this concept of exclusive remedy, and what that means is you're injured or you became ill because of work. We're going to file a work comp claim. We're going to take care of your medical expenses. We are going to pay you replacement wages. That person can't sue you then, with a few very minor exceptions that we don't have time to go into. But generally, that now creates a bubble around you, too, as the employer. You've gotten the person the help and the issues that they need to help recover. You cannot be sued for their injury. So don't be penny wise and pound foolish on this. And my rule of thumb about if you're ever going to decide to terminate somebody that has recently or is currently out on a work comp leave, it's not impossible, but it is definitely one where seek legal counsel because these go wrong fast and expensively. Travel time pay is, again, we could spend a half an hour talking just about this, but this is an area where companies do tend to get in trouble. As a reminder, when somebody's commuting between home and the workplace, it's not compensable time, but if we send the worker or the employee to a different location, or they are sent after they report to work to a different location, we then start the clock. And again, I'm talking about hourly non-exempt employees. So if we ask the person to travel to a client's offices or we ask them to go out of town, we've got to make sure that we are paying them for their time as well as their commuting costs, usually in the form of mileage if they're driving, when they are going outside of their regular work area. And this is a federal rule. When it's overnight travel away from home, and if it cuts across what the federal government calls the normal workday, so if my employee normally works from 9 to 5 and I ask them to engage in overnight travel, if they are traveling in between the hours of 9 to 5, whether it be on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, or even on the weekend, if it's in those 9 to 5 hours, I have to pay them for that time. And if they are traveling in a train, plane, boat, or bus away from home and it is not cutting into that normal workday, that is not paid time. Anybody in California with me here, raise your hand, but this is absolutely not the rule in California. In some states, again, the rules are very, very different. So if you are looking for rules about travel pay in your specific area, please reach out to me and I'll help get that to you. California, I'll just mention because it's a crazy state and it's where I happen to be headquartered. If you are sending somebody out of town on travel and it doesn't matter if they get to watch a movie or they're sleeping on that plane ride, California disagrees with the federal government and says all of those hours are paid time. So it can get expensive and it's tricky. This is another favorite mistake of mine where we have an employee that is ill, injured, out of work, and we've got multiple issues we have to worry about. Family Medical Leave Act, workers' comp, or ADA. Now, that CFRA, that again is a bit of a mistake in the slide. I apologize for it. I'll have that corrected and we'll re-upload them. That only applies in California. That is California's equivalent of FMLA. Many jurisdictions around the country do have their own FMLA type of family medical leave where the rules can be very, very different. When this is where companies get in trouble, they forget that when somebody goes out and they're ill, we can have those different types of leaves running concurrently. We have a tendency when someone does get hurt at work to process their work comp claim, but we forget that they're probably entitled to an FMLA or a state-specific leave at the same time. So we should be getting them the correct forms and notices and counting the time that they're out on work comp towards their FMLA or state leave. So a big mistake that I see companies engage in. And then the added difficulty, let's say somebody goes out on a work comp leave and it's also covered under FMLA and they get to the end of their legal entitlement of 12 weeks under FMLA leave, the person's condition at that point might rise to the level of their being considered disabled where ADA rules are going to kick in. And the federal EEOC tells us very, very clearly that if your company has a practice of automatically terminating employees when they exhaust their protected leave, they consider that illegal and discriminatory. They require you to at least chat with the employee and consider some additional leave as a reasonable accommodation. So if you're not doing that and you're being too black and white, terminating people at the end of protected leaves, you've potentially got a discrimination lawsuit waiting to happen. Anytime you're going to terminate an employee when they are in the middle of a leave of absence or just after a leave of absence, you need to be on heightened alert because you don't want that person turning around and claiming that you violated his or her rights to leave to accommodation under ADA. And keeping work comp, FMLA, state leave, and ADA issues all at the forefront when you're dealing with a specific individual being out is complex. It's hard to do. So note of caution in that area. All right. Many of you may be in states or cities where we have paid sick leave laws. This is a huge trend across the country right now. It is on the rise. Since this slide was published, we had another state. So again, we'll correct the slide. It's now 8 states and 32 cities and counties that have their own paid sick leave law. A federal requirement went into place beginning of this year for all federal contractors to provide paid sick days to their workers. President Obama had pushed for federal legislation. We don't know what the Trump administration is going to do. There's some talk about maybe providing some kind of federal law that would give a certain amount of paid sick time to employees and would preempt the state and city laws that we're seeing across the country right now. We just don't know. It's a huge area. It's a huge question mark. But it has become a very, very challenging area, and we're going to breeze through the next few slides that are there for references for you, but it's to illustrate how complex this has become. Here are the states, and again, when I update the states, I'll add New Jersey, which is going to go into effect, I believe it is June next year. These are the states that have their own different paid sick leave law, and you can see, of course, everyone couldn't figure out one methodology. We had to come up with our own versions. So if you have employees in California or Massachusetts and Vermont, you've got to handle your paid sick leave law differently, or you've got to have a policy that was considered carefully to be generous enough to comply with the de minimis requirements in all of your different locations. These are the cities as of now, cities and I think there's counties, cities and counties that have their own paid sick leave law. I hope you guys can see that.
It's good.
Okay. California, because we have to like try to be the winner all the time with being the most complex. These are the cities in California currently that have their own paid sick leave law on top of and in addition to the state law. So you may have to comply in California with the state requirement, but if you've got employees in any of these other locations, you have to make sure that whatever your policy is also meets the obligations of the city requirements. New Jersey wins. Usually California is the winner for being the one that's the most complex and having the most level of challenge with compliance, but we had this rash back in the last couple of years of all of these different cities in New Jersey coming up with their own slightly different version of paid sick leave laws. And it'll be interesting to see if that the fact that New Jersey has now passed a state law that goes into effect next year, maybe that will quell some of these cities or additional cities from passing their own specific laws. But we actually talked to a company, it was a trucking company in New Jersey. I was out there doing some training, and they literally had like a location in six of these different cities and were so challenged with having to have one handbook. As much as these, it looks as though these laws are very similar in New Jersey, you can see from the next slide that there's some minor nuances that make a difference from one city to the next. So that, to finish up on paid sick leave, it's a challenging thing to do right now to come up with what we call blanket policies, where you look at the different jurisdictions in which you have employees and to try and come up with one policy that meets the legal requirements everywhere. Not impossible, but very, very challenging. Some companies decide to go that route and put the time and energy into finding that one policy that covers everyone. Some companies have just said, nope, we're just going to publish a handbook that either has addenda attached to it or has details of, you know, here's the different policy for each state of operation. The government's not making it easy for us in that area. And then drawing to an end of our time here, and this is what I had alluded to before, I just wanted to share with you my mistake number 10, thinking that you'll never be sued. It's a question of time. It's a numbers game. The more employees you have, the more years you are in business, the more likely it is going to be that there's going to be some employee that gets unhappy and you're going to end up getting a letter from an attorney. There is no such thing as one big happy family. We can be all big, one big happy family, but unfortunately the day that you decide or need to let somebody go or they feel that they haven't been treated fairly, things devolve and companies get sued. It's just an unfortunate reality of the society that we live in right now. Companies too often point to competitors or large companies and say, hey, well, you know, such and such does it this way, and they've never been sued. That doesn't mean that you won't. It doesn't mean that they won't. These statistics are across the United States, so if you're in some of the more litigious states or the more expensive states, these numbers are probably higher, but the average cost right now to settle out of court, $75,000. So the person who asked the question of, you know, do we fight it or do we take it to court, the average case, the average cost to settle, to go to a jury verdict is $250,000. So if I'm faced with, I'm going to spend $250,000 in legal fees to get a jury verdict in my favor, or I could have just written the person a check for $35,000 to make the problem go away, that's a hard question to answer. I had a client that once fought a sexual harassment case where she paid, and this wasn't a lot, it was a small claim, but she paid $70,000, and the employee only wanted $2,000 to settle. And my client said, no, it's a question of principle. This was a situation where they felt that it was a completely fictitious claim. And the client said, I just can't, in good faith, give somebody money for lying and making something up. And if I do it with this person, it sends the message to everyone else that it's okay to do that. But I have to say that, you know, the fact that she was willing to take $70,000 out of her pocket for principle, maybe not all of us would have the wherewithal to do that. So 67% of cases rule in favor of the plaintiff, which is the employee. And unfortunately, across the United States, 10% of the employment-related cases that go to a jury trial end up with a verdict in excess of $1 million. Those are scary numbers. So I don't want to be a fear monger, but all of the things that I've just spent the last hour sharing with you, they can be really, really costly to your organization. I will mention that if anyone doesn't have employment practices liability insurance, which is called EPLI, talk to your broker who provides maybe your work comp or your general liability. You can get insurance to protect you against employment-related claims. And you can, depending on the cost, you can decide on the level of deductible that you would have. And it can be really great protection for companies because, unfortunately, these types of lawsuits are just on the rise across the country.
So that can cover sexual harassment or pretty much everything you think of?
Yes, sexual harassment, discrimination. Look carefully to see if it covers wage and hour claims. In California these days, it's hard because we have so many wage and hour claims, it's hard to find a policy that does cover wage and hour claims, but it's that you can, and if there's just a cost to it. It would not cover intentional or dishonest acts, but it will cover your company for a lot of these employment-related type of claims that can happen.
Would EPLI cover independent contractors?
Would it cover your misclassifying an independent contractor?
Yes.
It potentially could. That's going to fall into the category of a wage and hour claim. That's going to be very specific to, you know, the fine print in your policy.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yep.
Well,
just another 2 cents on EPLI policies. Many times they come with the requirement that you use the insurance company's legal counsel to represent you. You can find policies that allow you to pick your own attorney if that's something you care about. You know, make sure you read the fine print.
Okay.
Right.
We covered a lot of territory today, and we're going to open up the line in just a minute here. But I'm going to turn off the recording feature in just a moment, but I want it to be on the record. Thank you, Lorraine.
You're very welcome.
Absolutely amazing. And if anyone wants to reach out to Lorraine, you have the contact information. We're going to have our next program on January 18th, our next open line program. And the title is It's Always Time to Raise the Hiring Bar. Barry Deutsch will be doing that program. Some of you will know Barry is a national speaker, one of the top visit speakers in the country for many years, and it's going to be a very lively topic. We will be sending out some updated slides and audio in the next couple of days to you all. And again, thank you for attending Open Line. So everyone, please hold the line. But I would ask everyone to put your phone on mute and not on hold, otherwise we'll all hear music, and there's a lot of people attending today. So put your phone on mute and then unmute it if you have a question for Lorraine when we open the lineup. So please stand by, and we'll be right back, and you can talk directly with Lorraine.